Yeah, the last 2 years have been a little bit choppy.
I don't want to be.
We wrote it up and wrote it down.
I don't want to be overly rigid about cutting off discussion on things if they have some momentum. And I felt like there were still a couple of comments out on the question of the veto. John, you may have had a follow-up question about that. So let's finish that up, and then we'll come on back to the question of bicameralism.
The degree of there's a question in political science about the degree of uncertainty over the president's position. And what I've been puzzled in looking at statements of administration policy and the different grades of veto threats. Now, what Max said about Ford's approach made a lot of sense in that it's sort of an either or. Yes, we're going to veto it or we're not. But the grades of veto threats puzzle me a little bit, because it would seem that a lower grade threat, such as a secretary threat, conveys a yellow light to Congress. And while the presidential veto threat is a clear red light, why would you ever want to give a yellow light on a veto threat? It's almost inviting Congress to ignore it.
Well, it's often the requests often come from the our congressional side up there wanting some more ammunition to fight it out in committee. So I think it's both, as Fred and Larry said, anything below the presidential is a sign we want to negotiate. And so you go back in and say, hey, look, you know, if you fix X, Y, and Z, you know, and it's most useful as, you know, just a detailed indication. Again, OMB does most of the work of, you know, what we'd like to see change, like to at that level of the yellow light, as you say. But often, you know, those are, you know, the various threats are requested from Congress, which is a way to fix things in committee, and which is the first pest, but then also on the floor. And then the other thing sometimes you run into is you'll get, you know, certain senators going, come on, you know, we need a veto threat.
Yeah,
you know, oh, come on, you know, the president's got to stand up on this one. And we're going, okay, well, you know, let's see the votes.
You're going to work your colleagues to make sure we get
yeah, you know, where are we on this, et cetera, like that. So sometimes you're invited and induced to do this. But since it's the president's name and reputation on the line, you know, we tend to be cautious about that.
There's one other dimension that I was just talking to Stephen about here, and that is on several occasions you're pressured by your own cabinet,
right.
Who may have a particular interest. And there's one example that I was just alluding to. It's a complex one, but Pete Domenici and Secretary Richardson were in a New Mexico-based fight over the labs, the energy labs in New Mexico. And you'll remember this one, Chuck. Secretary Richardson insisted over and over again that we do a presidential veto on a defense authorization bill, a relatively important defense authorization bill. If I remember, we were at war with Kosovo at the time. And he wanted a presidential veto because he did not want Domenici running the New Mexico labs, largely for political reasons, I think. But there were others. I mean, Domenici was probably well overreaching for what a congressional power should exercise over a cabinet department. But that was an immense fight that we ultimately talked him out of it. We refused to do a presidential veto, and I think we were right. We would never have been able to sustain it. So.
I'll give you another example, an appropriations bill, not one of the major ones, with a ranking friend in the Senate, a particular issue, environmental issue, and he was not able to keep the rider out of the bill. He came to us and said, you know, I need you to say you're going to veto this bill. The bill was otherwise fine. It's perfectly acceptable. The issue, even from our perspective, is, you know, could go either way. He wanted it. We said the president will veto. And everybody on the Hill looked and said, we understand. You know, that's got to go. And, you know, he won. You know, used the nuclear bomb for this member in this instance. But I think the ambiguity that maybe political scientists, you know, are seeing about the threat frequently reflects ambiguity surrounding the bills.
Yeah.
You know, very seldom black or white. This, I just used an example there. You know, I mean, it was clear where we were going. Some particular riders, you know, Mexico City abortion, you know, some emotional things. The issue I was referring to yesterday, bankruptcy reform. Literally, sitting around the chief of staff's office, what would we do? You know, is it a good bill or is it a bad bill? And there are pluses and there are minuses. we close the administration not knowing what we would do if that came to us. Not any particular indecision, but it just, you know, so I think those, what you see, red lights, yellow lights inviting reflects people sitting around the table saying, what will we do?
So. Yeah, can I add something? You also get, you're trying to gather information, whether it's a good bill or a bad bill. And oftentimes you'll get different information. You might have an OMB do an analysis or Treasury do an analysis. And one of them says it's a good bill, the other says it's a bad bill.
Exactly.
Right?
Yeah.
Very good. Okay, let's move to the question of bicameralism then. I am a product of this government department here, and I feel like I got a very good education in Washington politics while I was here, but my true education about the politics of Capitol Hill came really as I was leaving this department and began dating a woman who was working at that time on the House side, who is a woman now seated to my right over here on the back bench that I later married and who later went to work on the Senate side. And one of the deeply embedded lessons that I discovered when I first moved to Washington after we got married was that there really is a very deep divide between the House side and the Senate side of Capitol Hill, right? Fred's objecting to this. But there's a sense of a kind of social as well as a professional distance, and that there are two, at least to a very close observer from the outside, they're two very different worlds on Capitol Hill. So the subject for discussion now is, how does a president deal with these two very different universes at the opposite end of Pennsylvania Avenue? And to help me out with this question, I've asked to lead off here Larry Stein, who is a creature of the upper chamber, and Max
like
Frieder's
court.
That's a very, very good way to do it, Ross.
He's already going in the wrong direction.
Stop the tape.
The other chamber.
Max Friedersdorf, whose experience is in the United States House before.
But he had some Senate, too.
Right. I mean,
we have the appropriations process.
Okay. So, Larry,
well,
give us a start.
It's a little...
The House representative shall originate all revenue bills.
It's a little daunting, and I don't have a... I'm just going to try to provide a point of access to what I think is a vast area, because you're right. I mean, it's literally two different cultures. The rules are the beginning point, and I think the rather rude observation was made that the Senate has none. I think, as John pointed out, you could also say the Senate has too many. I mean, the Senate is chaos and the House is absolute order. And I think that's the simplest way to start to think about it. To me, at least at this point, it's more useful, at least, to get below sort of the abstract level of the differing rule structures and to look at them a little bit politically, because I have my own experience was, and I'll postulate this for people to ridicule, but I used to ignore anywhere from 70% to 90% of the things the House did, largely because most of them were on suspension. We had the divided government. Most of it was stuff that Gingrich was doing for symbolism. He never expected it even to be taken up in the Senate, and in most instances it was not. And taking that little premise, I'd like to sort of make an observation about what's going on in the House. And it struck me as a paradox. John and I have talked about this. It's curious because every two-year cycle, there are, I think it was alluded to earlier, a very, very small number of House districts that are contended up for grabs. And getting less, I think, Chuck. Is that
right.
Your
yeah.
sense?
Yeah.
And yet, and those districts are almost exclusively swing districts where it's neither urban nor rural. They are districts that require pretty subtle politics, where you're going to be a moderate and you're going to try to position yourself in the center and you're going to try to get votes from both sides. And yet, even though that's the big enchilada in determining who's going to have power, if you look at the way the House has gone recently, it's been extraordinarily to the extremes. That is, each side is its rhetoric and its message are aimed at the base. And particularly in the Democratic Party, it was always sort of astonishing that when I was in the White House, I always felt that they were pushing drastically towards their base vote, towards the very, very liberal vote. And what really was needed if they were going to take back the House, which was supposed to be their holy grail, was some set of political constructions that would enable their moderates to win swing districts. So I'm not sure that I'm getting into it the right way, but that's something that has sort of beguiled and befuddled me. I have not been able to figure out why that's the case, but I think that it has rendered a lot of the House votes. Chuck, correct me if I'm wrong, but we used to ignore a lot of them.
I think take it further. I mean, from our jobs, we talked about it yesterday. We had to ignore. John really hit this. Ignore a lot of what Congress was doing. Be it House suspensions and post offices, fine. But the Senate would do those too. But we had to pay attention to the issues that really mattered for the president's agenda, mm-hmm. and both advancing an agenda or stopping things. And so you're looking at maybe 10% of the volume of things coming through.
Mm-hmm. Max?
Well, I was very fortunate, Russ. I had 10 years when I first came to Washington as an administrative assistant in the House. And when I look back, I think about those years, it was like the Senate did not exist. And we were totally oblivious to what was going on in the Senate. You're living in your own, it's like two worlds. Then I did have experience as a staff director of a committee in the Senate. And then I started thinking that the House didn't exist, and that the only thing in the world was the Senate. But it is like the Senate's more like the House of Lords, and the Senate's like the House of Lords, and the Congress is like Parliament. But you have to get back to basics when you start setting up a staff, and you look for, obviously, when you set up a staff on your Senate side, you want people that have worked on the Senate side. On the House, you want people that worked on the House side, and that's what we did. But from the perspective of the presidents, it was interesting to me because Nixon had been both a member of the House and Senate, so he was not biased in either direction. He had good friends on the Senate side and good friends on the House side, and he cultivated both bodies. When Ford came in, it was totally House. I mean, he was buddy-buddy, first-name basis with 435 members of the House. And in fact, many of them still referred to him as good old Jerry, and it was just like he was still a member of the House. So we needed strength on the Senate side, and that was not his forte, and we tried to beef up the Senate side with strong people. And then when President Reagan came to town, he, of course, had not served in either body, House or Senate, and the first thing he wanted to do was meet the leadership. And he was very anxious to become familiar with the House and Senate. And I think the first formal event we had after he went to the Hill and met the leadership was to have a private dinner in the residence with the Speaker and Mrs. O'Neill. And that was started a good relationship with the Speaker at that time. He was more willing, actually, than and I could have imagined, on willing to meet with congressmen and senators. There's not he was willing to make phone calls, and he became, at least during the time I was there in the first term and then early in the second term, he had become quite familiar with most of the key congressmen and senators and got to know them on the first-name basis. But there's no question you've got to deal. Each of those senators, it's almost like they're a fiefdom up there. It's like each one of them has a little country they're running, and their staffs are huge. Their committees are loaded with people. You're dealing with an awful lot of people, whereas on the House side, Congressman, when I first went there, we had four people. I know it's increased quite a bit since then. We had AA, LA, the receptionist and a secretary. And I think now probably they have five times that many. But no question, they're both different bodies, and you've got to, you can't treat them the same. You've got to work with the differences.
Let me pose a general question for everybody. Is it possible to say whether the House or the Senate is intrinsically more difficult to lobby from the White House perspective? In other words, is there something about the nature of the bodies that makes one of them more difficult?
Well, just a couple observations is, generally I found, I grew up in the Senate, but I found the House members more knowledgeable about the specific subject matter because they were not stretched nearly so thinly. And so you could talk to a House member much more about the substance of the bill. They were more tuned into the substance of the bill than a Senate member tended to be. The Senate member had to, except in some rare exceptions of exceptional senators, really rely on their staff and their committee to take them through that. Sort of the second point is echoing what Larry said. I think the implication of this is, I think, again, this can be discounted because I do come from the Senate, I'll say that, but I think the Senate has become much more important a place to lobby by the nature of the events of the last decade, which is we have this split party, no one has a supermajority. And so, when you walk into the Senate at 60 votes on bills that are not filibusterable, that can be filibustered, that has a moderating influence. And so, all sorts of stuff comes out of the House, depending which party is controlled, which is sort of off the wings of each party, and more at the extremes. And so the moderation and getting it ready to be signed, the real working of the bill can best be done in the Senate. And again, another point is that because the members tend to be less polarized also because, they appeal to a wider constituency in their state. So I think that the more important body these days to be lobbied is the Senate, because as it comes over from the House, a leadership passed bill, that's the opportunity to sort of moderate a little bit on either side. And then the final point, I think, again, as we said yesterday, where the House really has its impact is through the leadership and the centralization of authority there, because as the growth of these omnibus bills has come along because of the Budget Act, bills tend to be sort of litigated and negotiated at the leadership level. So the real impact of the House comes back sort of at the end, where the leadership steps in and says, with the Senate leadership in the White House, how can we get a bill that will pass?
One problem with the Senate is that about half of them are always running for president.
Yeah. And the other half think they ought to be president.
It should be acclaimed.
Right.
And, I've heard this story, I'm sure Frank has it. Senator Russell, when freshman senators would call on him, he would make this clear that senators enjoyed, unlike members of the other body, enjoyed 6-year terms. And senators were expected to be statesmen for 2 years. Occasionally, their second 2 years could, once in a while, demagogue an issue a little bit. And then the last 2 years, senators would understand they had to run for re-election. And you think about, you mentioned, Jim, earlier, the perpetual campaign. That may be a dimension of the Senate that is changing, but it certainly, in a way, for a president, makes it sometimes more difficult to gain the support of senators with conflicting constituencies in that first 2 years or the second 4 years of a 6-year term. They're going to be some senators who are a lot less loyal to an incumbent president of their party or more in opposition to a president of the other party when they are not facing the voters immediately. So I think that makes, in some ways, the Senate a more challenging in terms of hurting those who are on the edges of either party into an important position.
And in analysis of some of the votes, particularly some of the closer votes in the Senate, where you see parties, folks not towing the line of where the president wants them to be, You know, it's like, okay, you're gonna get a, you can walk on this one because you were able to make up that vote somewhere else. Oftentimes, driven by the leadership and their sort of vote whip count that we share with. So it's a sometimes a record cannot on its on the surface may not reflect the texture of what was going on at that point in time. Yeah, you got to pass on this one then, because you've got an issue and you're up for re-election. So.
I mean, I share the views and actually sort of feel the views of this sort of this chasm between the two bodies. And frequently, and I think part of it's a result, not only are you living in your own world, but the only time you're really going to the other body is in conference. And in conference, you know, I mean, nobody's put it in the record yet, but, you know, the old line of, you know, the Democrats or the Republicans are, you know, aren't the problem. You know, the problem is the Senate. And I'd, you know, go off to conference and you cross that point in the midpoint of the Capitol.
Demarcation line.
Right. And say, feel it, the air's getting thinner. but looking at it from the perspective of the administration, you can use that chasm because you're the only one that is talking to everyone. And it gives you second and third bites out of the apple. You're looking for people who share your views. Well, if you haven't won here, maybe you can win there.
Yeah.
And by, you know, bolstering your allies, you know, even in conference, you know, you go back to a few House members. You know, maybe you didn't win in the House, you won in the Senate.
That's a really
good taking care of your House friends. Trying to not manipulate the process, but you've got your tentacles all over. If you do it right, you use that lack of communication and affection.
And you know, just to follow up on that though, but when you ask is one harder than the other, I think the most useful way to think of it is sort of holistically and in terms of a specific case. I mean, and what Chuck's saying is true. Since the two are separate and you're down at the White House, you have a huge advantage. You know what's going on. You can play them off against each other. And I think take the way Bush probably has to do it right now and has been doing it. He will start with a House where he gets passage for his most extreme desires.
That's right.
And he starts with that as a premise. And then he tries to figure out how much he can get in the Senate so that when it comes to... So it's really not a question of easy or harder. It's a question of understanding where both of them are at any given point, using one against the other, as Chuck's saying, or in combination. I do think the hardest part of it, though, is the political differences between the two. I just think that the House, to me, is so much more so strident right now, so partisan, so difficult. That I think is an element that makes the mechanics just much more difficult to decide on. I'm sorry.
Dick, you had a question?
I just wanted to ask, since the the leadership has no formal place to meet except with the president, is this an advantage for the people you represent? And if so, how do you use it?
I think it is an advantage. And more in terms of just, as Frank was indicating what the agenda is, indicating the priorities.
Mm-hmm.
And even getting them in the room saying, well, this seems to be okay with them. Do you think you can bring your guys along? So I think you do use it, but when the leadership is running well, and it always hasn't been functional, you know, they are meeting together.
Yes, of course.
And not only, you know, and it always hasn't worked well. I mean, I think Denny Hastert and Pelosi, Gephardt have spent a lot more time together than Gingrich and Gephardt ever did. Interesting, and this is more a congressional perspective, the Republican leadership, House and Senate, have moved their offices onto the west front on the same floor. Mm-hmm. So literally here to the end of the building,
mm-hmm.
you've got the two leaders which more different, and the Democratic leadership is still, it's 50 yards, it's a different world, and the Daschle Pelosi walk is more difficult,
yeah,
and probably done less frequently, I think.
Yeah.
Go ahead, John.
On the same point, but from a little bit of a different perspective, again, referring to my early interview study, I interviewed some people in the House and the Senate. I interviewed Senator Dirksen, spent a while with him, the Republican leader in the House, and we were discussing, the utility or the advantage of the congressional relations staff. And Dirksen maintained that it was of great use to him. He said, they used to set up camp right here outside of my office. And he said, one of the advantages to me was they knew what was going on the other side, and implying that this was a way in which, for intelligence purposes, about what was going on in the other house. And I got the same confirmation from some of the leaders on the Senate side.
Absolutely.
On the House side, that they, my question was, what good are they to you? And this was among the things that they mentioned about.
It used to work the other way for me when I was in the Senate, because I used to call you to find out what was going on in the House.
Yeah.
Because really, we had no way of knowing.
Yeah.
And frequently, if we tried to find out, the House guys wouldn't tell us.
Mm-hmm. Could you get back to Professor Neustadt's observation of the leadership has no place to meet? Congressional relations generally has no place on the Hill either.
Right.
We camped out, outside of Leader Gephardt's office. And at one point, before I was there, it was some particular tough, and supposedly a staffer ripped out all the phones in this little hallway. Said, we couldn't meet, couldn't be there anymore. There was no, other than using the Vice President's office.
Which is on the Senate side.
Which you can, use their facilities. There's no place you can go,
We use the Whip's office when.
Yeah, but it's all ad hoc.
Yeah, yeah.
All ad hoc. Use a payphone. If your relations aren't good, here's a payphone.
We used to,
thank God for saying.
During a vote, this was during the Ford administration when we were trying to sustain all those vetoes, we used to station ourselves. There was a lobby between the floor and the men's restroom. And you would send in a message, you wanted to see Congressman so-and-so, and of course he would ignore it. But when the debate was long, eventually he would come out to use the restroom and we would catch him in that little lobby. And one day we sustained a veto by about 2 votes on a real crucial one. I think it was emergency medical services. And we were celebrating out there in the lobby after the vote. It was just a minute or two after the vote. And Tip O'Neill come flying through the doors and out there. And he didn't grab me, but he went right up against my chest. And he said, Friedersdorf, if I ever see you in this lobby again, I'll ban you from the Capitol. He said, you will not be in this lobby again. And they banned congressional relations from coming into that lobby for the rest of the time. I don't know where you can go in there now or not, but he wouldn't let us in there then. So we just stand out in the hallway after that and try to
steps.
Try to catch him.
As you get further and further away.
Well, I want to ask, the Vice President's position has come up here, and actually that was the subject of some conversation over dinner last night. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about the Vice President's role. This seems to be an appropriate spot to raise that. Talk a little bit about the Vice President's role in the entire congressional relations operation. I would expect that it would be highlighted on the Senate side, but are there instances in which it takes place on
I'll
the House?
I'll start there. We had Vice President Quayle in our shop, and Vice President Quayle, particularly in the Senate, but also in the House, was sort of a nice link back to sort of the conservative block of the Republican Party in the Congress. And I often used him to sort of ferret out what was going on and so we'd know what we were going to be up against when, as we tried to get enough votes to do something. Quill also was very useful in terms of the House. Some of it stemming primarily from his days as a senator and having been a member of the body and having dealt with the House on issues while he was a member of Congress. So we used him an awful lot in our lobbying process. And of course, when Bush was vice president, we did the same thing.
Well, can you tell us about it?
Well, the vice president does, I think, to this day, vice presidents go to the Senate policy lunch for the Republicans, so they're on the Hill at least once a week. It was certainly useful for then Vice President Bush to, at the policy lunch and in other informal meetings, engage senators, and I had regular contact with him in terms of issues. During 87, he had to break a number of tie votes. Unfortunately, I think two consecutive back-to-back votes that he had to break the tie on were on biological chemical warfare research. And I remember the morning of a cabinet meeting where we had DOD bill was on the floor, and he had just had to go to the Hill to break two successive votes 2 weeks before that, and had received a phone call from his mother because she had read in the papers that he had twice broken the tie and enabled the research on chemical biological weapons to proceed. I think this was the Pryor Amendment when David Pryor was trying to curtail research, I should put it that way. So it was a complicated issue, but in the middle of a cabinet meeting, the steward came in and handed the vice president a note. And it was the worst possible news. The Senate was stuck in a 50-50 tie on yet another effort to address funding for this kind of weapons research. And he stood up to get the quick car up to the Hill and said, turned to President Reagan and said, "Mr. President, while I'm up at the Senate, would you mind calling my mother?" So he did his job and was glad to do it. But it was but he did spend a great deal of time up there, and though he had served in the House, not in the Senate, he engaged his role as President of the Senate very vigorously.
Well, let me ask you about that comment, because I'd be interested in your observations about his sense of the House of Representatives. Did you feel like he was somebody did he spend much time working on the House side? Has his experience been in such a different era that it really didn't apply to so much of the?
No, he had maintained close relationships with a number of the key. And Dan Rostenkowski had close personal relationships. Samuel Montgomery, a number of key members that he had served with. Yes. So though he had, I don't think he spent as much time physically on the House side owing to his Senate duties, but he. He had ongoing and continuous informal contact with him.
Okay.
And it was, of course, this was the 80s, the second term of the Reagan administration, and he was clearly seeking the nomination, intended to run for the presidency. So he was, he was maintaining those contacts and was an active part of it.
I think he spent a fairly good amount of time over in the House. You could always tell when the Secret Service is standing outside the House gym. Vice President Bush was up in the gym, working out, and it happened fairly regularly. But Will, in talking about breaking ties in the Senate, I think logistically, just pure mechanics, that's one of the toughest things to do, is know when there's going to be a tight vote, and where the Vice President's going to be, and okay, when do you get him back? I mean, it might be one thing if he's there in a meeting or if he's in his office. If he's up at the residence, it's 10 o'clock at night. Or on the other hand, if he's traveling, if he stopped to travel. And a series of judgment calls that are, personal level, tough to make.
Others of you have stories about vetoes? Go ahead, Frank.
Oh, vetoes or vice president?
Well, vice president.
Vice president. Well, I had the opposite. Vice President Mondale was our vice president. He'd been in the Senate for maybe 12 years, three terms. 18 years. We left in the middle. but he was on the Finance Committee for, I think, 11 years. So he had a lot of close ties, but it was with the liberal wing party, both in the Senate. And we used him a lot. Not so, I think he only had to break one tie vote. It made a lot of people mad at him, a lot of his buddies. But informally, luncheons in the vice president's office, you know, in the office building, not the one off the floor, are just in a private room. And just everybody let their hair down and gripe, and, you know, he'd bring the message back. Or what was particularly helpful was the Bureau, what he called the Bureau of Naval Affairs, which was the Senate steam room. When he told his secretary he was going to the Bureau of Naval Affairs on an important mission, he was going to the Senate steam room. And you knew always Lawton Childs was in there. Senator Percy from Illinois was always in. He had a certain time, you know, 4 o'clock in the afternoon. It's going to be a vote that night. There were predictably about 4 senators you just knew would be there. I guess you'd go to certain bars, and, you know, somebody's going to be sitting at the stool. So he'd go up and kind of fill them out and talk, but just informally, and of course give us the feedback. It was very, very, very helpful. On the House side, he'd go have lunch with the Minnesota delegation, which by definition was liberal, most of the people there. And then they would start expanding that in sort of a ad hoc liberal caucus. But very, very helpful to gather information.
On Gore.
I actually think there's probably multiple books in Gore's vice presidency as it relates to his colleagues in both the House and Senate, because it's an incredibly complex thing. Going back both to his extended service in the Senate and his earlier service in the House, he had friends and he had enemies. And maybe more of the latter than the former, in all honesty. But compounding all that was the fact that, especially during the second term, Clinton's second term, Gore was obviously the heir apparent, making him, for Republicans, an absolute target. And anything he was for became something they were against. But in truth, I mean, there was resentment inside the Democratic Party as well amongst those who thought they should be the heir apparent, which is, as we were saying, always with us. So the using Vice President Gore for advancing an agenda was a complex matter, very complex, and also trying to defend an agenda that he had gone to great lengths to try to lay out as his own, and that the Republicans knew about pretty well, that became part of the job, because, you know, it was understood that we in the White House, we wanted him to be able to succeed the president. So, you know, there were a lot of different incidents, but, you know, the one that strikes me as one where we actually won one, and that was, Chuck was referring to how difficult it is to locate them sometimes and know. This was do you remember the gun show vote? Mm-hmm. Where this was right after Columbine. And very contentious, very, very tough, as all gun issues are, but this one particularly after Columbine. And Gore, if I remember right, it was either a birthday or an important anniversary, and he was having dinner with his wife somewhere, and we didn't know where. But it was very, very, I was virtually certain it was 50-50, and it was. Which was an enormous error on Trent Lott's part, an absolutely huge error on Trent Lott's part, because Gore got to ride in, cast the tie-breaking vote on a gun issue at a time of, and they should have thrown that vote, but they didn't. So, it's a good one.
That's good.
On Gore, internally, I've sensed, and you've got the last two-thirds of a changing role internally. I mean, say the last year when I was deputy, I think I ran into Gore in the West Wing twice in his office. You know, if you had people in for lunch, you could always know that you could take them up to the vice president's office, from the office, because he's not going to be there. And the stories from friends, you know, that earlier on he was involved in, you know, every major policy discussion they're working and whatnot. So that is a role internal to the White House that changed over time. And my job is doing House relations. I remember I was fearing it coming into the 98 election, that after the 98 election, we would have Democratic candidates for president, Al Gore and Dick Gephardt. And my job as House deputy was going to be hell, trying to walk that line. And then the day after the election, when it turns out the Democrats had picked up seats and were like within four, it was clear to me that Dick Gephardt was going to see that he had a better chance of becoming speaker than president. So he would quickly, you stay where he was. The next 2 years, you know, were fine because we were, as Larry was alluding to, we were all behind Gore. But it could have gone. But he was a lot more involved.
One of the things that sticks in my mind is that he, in my 2 years, he was very, very much involved in all the policy deliberations, sat in on everything. His staff was involved and really a part of the strategy team, from A to Z. And, often, he would disagree with some of the ways we were moving, particularly in 96, on some of the moves to the center. But I'll tell you, he would stand up and salute every time, and completely loyal, never batted an eye about where he stood, when we'd go out of the room, and he'd go out and perform, and completely, completely loyal. And just on Larry's point, at the end of the cycle, when, the appropriations bills, the all-nighters were going on, you could bet your britches that there was always Mexico City, the abortion issue. That was always the last issue. Okay, but before we got to the last issue, there was all of Al Gore's projects, his environmental stuff. That, as Larry said, the Republicans seeing him as the heir apparent, they would kill those programs, and we'd have to stand there and stare each other down until. Until we put those aside, and we got pretty visceral too. I mean, it was pretty, pretty ugly. And he could inflame the other side. I mean, one of his great uses was to send him up there and just throw a little gasoline around the place.
He was good at it.
And he was very, very, very good at it. So there was the main thing from my period was his complete loyalty to the president and really performing his ass.
Which he carried through impeachment. In a way that probably hurt him, but he carried it through, and that's something that people don't remember a lot of.
Well, let me ask you a question. Did you have a similar experience with Vice President Bush, given the fact that he was being viewed as the heir apparent? Was there a politically charged situation for him in the years that you were?
No, I don't think it was so politically charged for him, but it was it was not always easy in the sense that the Senate Majority Leader was also seeking the Republican nomination. So you can just think about the tension that was inevitable there. This was in 87, as the 88 primaries were drawing near, and the President had been very clear instructing the staff to not engage in this, in the political developments. But, and Howard Baker was then the chief of staff. There were some issues where the timing of some issues, Senator Dole was the leader, and so he would set certain issues. This was a time when the negotiations with the Soviets were at a pretty critical point in time. And there was a vote on the IMF treaty that we were attempting to get scheduled, and the Iowa caucuses were looming on the horizon. And Senator Dole had not yet declared whether he would vote for or against the IMF treaty. At the time, there was some debate ongoing about that particular treaty and what Soviet intentions would be. This is 1987, so this is, as it turned out, called a press conference, announced his support for the treaty. That was not an event that the Vice President thought was a good one to conduct at the White House. But at any rate, the treaty was then ratified. Gorbachev came to Washington. It was signed in the East Room. But all through that year, it was a difficult time with the president's agenda being subjected to a lot of forces, and then this political contest. It was some time before Vice President Bush made it, had secured the nomination. So. It was not quite the same in that environment as it was in the Clinton term, I don't think.
Dick, did you have a question?
Oh, like, oh.
Okay.
I'd like to follow up on the Vice President's involvement in policy deliberation in the Carter administration. From the outside, it looked like that Vice President Mondale was more involved than any other previous Vice President. In terms of working with the president and working certain policy areas, could you comment on that?
We said that was true. I don't know if it was true or not, but we did move him out of the DOB into the West Wing, and we negotiated the stuff at the convention. Three of us and three of Mondale's staff on what their role would be. What his would be, not before he was named, but afterwards, the day after. Dick Moe, Mike Berman, and Jim Johnson, and was myself and Jody and Hamilton. And what we agreed, he wanted to see all the papers that came across the president's desk, not to be excluded from any of those, Vice President Mondale. And I have to say, he had very strong feelings about it, because of Hubert Humphrey's experience with President Johnson.
Right.
And he'd heard all this stuff from Humphrey, Senator Humphrey, and that, you know, don't take the job unless. So they had a weekly lunch, private. Nobody knew what they talked about. Vice President Mondale never said anything. President Carter never said anything. Totally loyal. You have to remember, one of Carter's objectives was to balance the budget, and we got within $4 billion of it, and the last budget was 50. It was within $50 billion. That was a huge increase in defense. Well, I don't think Mondale was elected from Minnesota, thought he was, to go come to Washington and balance the budget, you know. But he was loyal in doing that, very loyal. And then he had, Bert Karp was a deputy in domestic policy. Elliot, one of his guys was over at OMB, and so he had him kind of salted around. But he was involved in all the policy, sat in all the meetings. He was invited. He didn't have to come, but he was invited to come to them. And he came to most of them. And even I don't think he ever designated, if he couldn't be there, I don't think anybody came in his place, but toward the end, Dick Moe or someone would sit in on the stuff. But he was involved in everything.
He did have one of the great lines, is back from 76, regarding office space, and I wasn't in Washington, but regarding being in the West Wing. He said, if you're not in the West Wing, you might as well be in Baltimore. And it's true.
Well, that yeah, but the Vice President has more offices than anybody else in town. Though, when you
add his Senate and
old exactly.
Yeah, it's
pretty good. That raises the question that I was going to ask before. Mondale told me once while he was Vice President that Humphrey had told him, and it was based not only on Humphrey's experience, but what he'd understood from President Johnson about his vice president's experience. Because there was a rule you always had to follow. Never, never be seen by a third party differing with the president unless it had been arranged in advance. Now, I believe that was a rule that the elder George Bush followed also. But you're saying that for at least 6 years, Gore did not have to. What changed?
That he didn't have to follow the president's lead?
No, but he was obviously, from what was said here, he was allowed to, he felt himself free to differ with the president with when third parties
could see. Oh, I see, in internal.
Could see.
Oh, okay. Third parties meaning
inside,
even the inside,
inside
the White House.
Oh, yes, oh, okay. Absolutely.
No, I mean it was, I think, appropriately a very inclusive group that was involved in the policy, and obviously he was too. So we all consider ourselves, you know, part of the same team, but that was part of it, is he would have his views, and as would, you know, the Treasury Secretary and the R&B Director and all of us. And then at the end of the day, the president would decide, and we'd go out there and salute.
But Gore never diverged in a public way.
No, I understand that, but that was not what Mondale was talking about.
Let me understand
Mondale
that.
Mondale was saying you didn't...
Even in policy deliberations that were inside, in the Oval.
Yes. Unless he might say anything he wanted to at their private lunch, because nobody else was present.
Maybe on big things, but he sure join in, you know, say it's the craziest thing I've ever heard of, you know. You guys are talking about doing that, because here's what's going to happen to you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, say that.
Yeah, sure.
And if we did it, he'd say, okay.
But I think it gets to the involvement of the vice president in the policy discussions. If, you know, you're called in saying, here's what we've decided to do, well, the vice president then salutes and goes out. But to the extent that Gore, at least, was involved in the discussions, why be in the policy discussion if you can't have a view?
Yeah.
Exactly. So I think it's, you know, part of the changing role of the vice president that internally you've got your view just like he does and I do and you will.
Well, it changed somewhere along in this process that you all know about. And you're saying it changed earlier, that the late Mondale felt free.
Well, I mean, I remember, you know, early discussions. He would express his opinion. And if it didn't carry, like, you know, mine didn't usually, then we'd all salute and say this is the president's position, and he might have disagreed privately or sitting around in the Roosevelt room, but he never told anybody that outside the White House.
You think that was true also on the Hill, or are there instances where they had such close connections on the Hill that behind closed doors they might go in and say?
We would have heard. You would have known.
Yeah.
You would have known. You would have known in 6 hours.
Yeah.
6 minutes.
Yeah, it wouldn't take hours.
Well, I guess I got a definitive answer to that question. Let me go back to the question of conference. You raised that earlier. Is there any kind of internal delicacy on the Hill about being involved in conference, or were the members of conference committees particularly protective of their role, or was there a sense that that was an appropriate place for the White House to bring its... presence to bear?
We were invited to a lot of them. I mean, so starting off, I wasn't invited to sit at the table. I was a chair back here, but when you sort of got going, if you made sense, they said, well, scoot on, put on in here. But oftentimes you're being used by one side or the other, and you knew it, and everybody in the room knew it. So.
I think it really varies, and even the White House attitude towards the conference. You know, do you want to be in the room? I can remember, you know, a particular...
Please don't.
Right.
Yeah. I really don't want to come up there.
Where the outcome, we were going to have a bill, it was going to have the right title, it was going to do some percentage of the good things we wanted, but it was going to be, wasn't going to be 100%. And so we had a guy who was in there fighting for as much as he could, but, you know, when he came out and said, we've got the bill, here's as much as I could get, we were able to say, fine, that's great. But had I been in there, or somebody else, we would have been party to that direct compromise, and we've gotten killed. So it's, you know, ad hoc.
I'll tell you, we ran into that conference. Was Ross Mikowski's predecessor, Ullman, from Oregon. But he always wanted as many people in there with him when he was going up against Russell Long as he could get. I mean, he really did. Sometimes we didn't want to go. He'd say, come on, you know, what's your position? So you have a treasury guy stand outside the door, you know, and hand them papers.
I think it was one of the, that was, we were disadvantaged, I think, in some measure during the Andrews excursion that Chuck's boss and others were participating in because of our...
No, blame these guys. Blame
oh, it's the city guys who messed
it up? We didn't
want
to be there.
You didn't want to go there. But I think that there was, I mean, we were glad to participate to kind of know what was going on, but I think you were sort of disadvantaged in terms of the, so the information flow was good, but just sort of being there and getting the dynamics probably hurt in that situation.
Right. But strategically, then, there were reasons for you to want to avoid being in that place. Yeah, John,
it's changing, though, don't you? I mean, I think this energy bill pending now is a good example. I mean, increasingly, just to get a bill done, the House will send something over, the White House will wink at it just to move the process along, as was the case with the tax bill. And then the Senate will do whatever it takes to get its version, and the real work is done in conference. And it's quite different. Yeah. 10, 20 years ago, it was not the same kind of process.
I think in a lot of cases, conference is the crucial place.
Right.
I mean, I think you may not want to be there for a lot of reasons, but you pretty much have to be there sometimes. And you get beat up. I mean, you get beat up a lot by both sides. But either it can be a very high priority for the president, or you can have a veto threat out, as we were discussing before, and your credibility's on the line. And you've got to get it at least to a point where you can put a signature on it and not be too embarrassed. Or you in some cases, you're almost better off losing some of the ancillary issues when you're going to lose the big one, because then you have four reasons to veto it rather than one. And so there have been numerous occasions when I've just rolled over on a couple of
I can remember Larry getting yelled at in a very small room in the Capitol with stone walls. Senator McCain just ripping up him one side, coming down the other. And I just sat there and I said, thank God he's got the top job.
that was Y2K and Y2K liability. That's true. That's true. And we just sat there and said, we're going to veto it. We said we'd veto it. We're going to veto it. We didn't veto it. This was one where one of those late night calls to the president screwed the thing up. But
I think the interesting dynamic now, and Larry referred to the House sending extreme bills, the Senate sort of doing its thing, and then we're in conference. The issue for this president, but all of them face it, is, okay, do we want a bill? And can I sell the compromises necessary to get a bill to sort of my base? You know, will they take, do they want an issue? Will they take my leadership when I say, okay, energy, we're not going to get ANWR. Guys, we're going to live another day, we're going to get an energy bill, that's important. And then what does the base salute? They say, sorry, Mr. President, that's nice, but we want ANWR. That's a critical judgment that the White House has to make in conference, a test of leadership, and they bring folks along.
I think the conference is enormously important. It's one of the sort of the last stops. But I think a thing in all of us having been in the legislature that you appreciate is you never lose sight of the fact that it's the Congress that legislates. And so you've only got so many bullets at the end of the day where you can come in, so many vetoes, so many, annoying a chairman, telling him what you'd like him to do and not do. And so it reemphasizes the point about getting started early in the process, depending on your chairman, depending on the leadership, because at the end of the day, when all is said and done, and we've all been on that side, it really is 90% of the lifting. You got to put it off on the chairman and the leadership to help you out and get it done. Because absolutely. If you try to do it all yourself, there's just no way. So it's a part of getting in the process early and using, you pray you have a good leader who you can work with, who's loyal to the president, who'll do a ton of that lifting for you, and good committee chairman as well.
Let me approach this in a slightly different way then, and ask you, my assumption is that on procedural questions of the two bodies, that you steer completely clear of that. Maybe I'm wrong, but let me throw that hypothesis.
In what sense?
Well, in the sense that leadership elections or internal rules or things of that nature. Is that a false assumption? I'm sorry, Will, what did you say?
Up until recently, yes. Up until recently, we stayed out of leadership fights.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
There's no.
Like we didn't get involved in the gym, right?
Okay. Yeah, exactly. So my question is, are there other areas that the president's involvement or your involvement is sort of taboo? I mean, are there places where clearly the general signals from the Hill are butt out, this is our business and not your own?
They wanted to be taboo in the question of pay raises in legislative provisions providing pay raises, but frequently that's an area that you can exercise some influence on.
You don't want to talk to him about committee assignments or chairman assignments or rotation and that type of thing.
Or two chairmen fighting over something.
You better stay out of that.
Jurisdiction.
Yeah. Okay.
I'd like to follow up with Fred, just a quick one on the summit out at Andrews Air Force Base, mm-hmm. the 1990 Budget Enforcement Act. And ask about the involvement of legislative affairs out there compared to Darman. And the picture was
Darman was leading it.
Yeah, that he might have gone a little bit further than what people wanted him to go on the tax.
Because of whether you're talking about round one or round two.
Round two.
Round two, probably, most assuredly that, you know, it was sort of when we finally got to the point of no new taxes, read my lips, and tried to artfully define it as revenue enhancement as opposed to a tax increase, which is what it was. No, I think that was the Darman phrase. I don't know where it came from. Darman was leading that effort in both rounds of those negotiations with a very strong involvement of Sununu, because we got, you know, first round we had child care tax credits and all sorts of other things that were wrapped up in the package, which was the one that we lost on the House floor when Gingrich and his colleagues decided to not toe the line. Then we came back with round two, and I think we were disadvantaged from a negotiating standpoint when we went back, because it was pretty clear that those on the other side could say, well, look, you can't bring your own people to the table on this deal. So it gave an advantage from a negotiating standpoint, and we ended up giving up more than we wanted to, but we couldn't hold our folks. And so, you know, the numbers were what they were, and we ended up having a package different from. Now, when you look back in retrospect, you know, you've got the other piece of it, because that's when we started doing the floors and the ceilings and all those other things that added some discipline to the budget process at a point in time when, you know, all we sort of had hanging out there was Graham Rudman Hollings related types of things. In fact, if I remember correctly, you guys, when President Clinton first became president, actually ended up using our floor ceiling thing on something that was right out of the box. I don't want to say it had something to do with Veterans Affairs or something to that effect, but it was a... So, in hindsight, it had some usefulness, and you can make the argument as well that it had usefulness in terms of the economy beginning to turn around at the end of 1992. Just didn't happen soon enough, from a political standpoint.
Yeah. Ron Sinkowski was well known for not liking summit negotiations because he preferred bringing out his bill and then negotiating from there. Does that mean that the White House is advantaged in summit negotiations? I think a lot of you were involved in one of them or more. I'm just curious what your feeling is about the bargaining power of the White House in summit negotiations as opposed to the normal legislative sequence.
Depends on the negotiation. I mean, there were some. I think the 90 was, the president was disadvantaged from the start, very significantly. But at the big appropriations negotiations at the end of every year, I mean, that was a huge, the 90 was in magnitude a massive thing. And I actually agree with you, on balance, there was a lot of good policy in there. No good deed goes unpunished. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But at the end of every appropriations year, It's been, I think, demonstrated overwhelmingly that the president has the cards. And at least that's been my experience. You know, I did two or three of them, but I don't know what others think. But we always felt that we were in a much stronger position than the Republican leadership to get our priorities. And I think the record showed that we proved that true.
But I would say, from a constitutional perspective, and when I was on the Hill, I would frequently remind people in the White House, the Constitution gives the president one role in the legislative process. Decide whether or not to affix his name to it. And so once you let them in the room, and of course that, you know, I mean, that's, you know, a vast overstatement. You know, even, you know, you've heard stories here, you know, send it to us, we'll veto it, you know. But once you let them in the room, they've got something, you know, power, and whether or not it's a good negotiation, they're relatively powerful versus another negotiation. But you're in the room, you're a player, and in fact you've turned it into a three-party negotiation, House, Senate, you, when it's meant to be a two-party.
Absolutely. And one thing I'll never forget is Newt, you know, figured this out very early, that we had all the cards at the end of the day on these big bills. And, you know, we had the power to say, okay, guys, you want to be here in December, or do you want to go out and run for re-election,
right.
You know?
Exactly.
So Newt would come in the room and says, okay, what's the price for getting
what
a ticket punch? Yeah, what do I have to do? And
that's
we'd
true.
Say, okay, here's
that's
the list.
True.
And because he understood that at the margins, these appropriations matter. You know, they'll be back next year.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't to live or die for. And he'd rather have the card punched and get his guys out campaigning than sit there and fight.
But he got punished for that. His understanding of that, and he was entirely right. His right wing just has never accepted it. And they,
I guess it was
President Reagan did not. He hated the omnibus appropriation bill was something he had great distaste for,
right.
and he invested a lot of time and energy in advocating what the governor of California had, the line item veto.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, I was frequently in the Saturday radio address and was frequently in speeches, and but he liked the regular order in the budget and the regular order of 13 separate appropriation bills and the right to review each. So-called merit, so it was objectionable to him to have this huge bill. So I remember the State of the Union address in 87 when up came the text and it was passed around for review, and it was just a flat statement that I asked that Congress not send me a continuing resolution omnibus spending bill, and if you do, I will not sign it.
Mm-hmm.
Well. There ensued this vigorous internal debate, which I felt pretty strongly that was waving a red flag at the appropriators, and I thought that was not the right thing for the president to say in the State of the Union at the beginning of this session. So I went in with the State of the Union all but done, and the president typically 2-3 days before State of the Union sit down and rewrite passages himself, and I went in and made an appeal. Mr. President, this is not a sentence you need to use, because I think it'd be provocative, and I think it undercuts the appropriators. I think it does a lot. And he listened and said, "I can tell." He said, "I can tell you don't think I can pull this off." Anyway, to make a long story short, it stayed in the speech, and we go up to the Hill that night, and sitting there, and he gets to that part of the speech. And he had last year's CR sitting there, and he put that, you know, grimace on his face and said, "And I would ask that the Congress not send me," and he picked it up and plopped it on the desk with a big thud, "not send me one of these. I will not sign it." Both sides jump up. I look down before this Howard Metzenbaum cheering. Well, so much for my counsel. What works in the State of the Union.
Yeah, but how many of those have we had subsequently? Oh. Probably.
Right.
You were right.
Right. You were right. You were absolutely right.
I think it was 2000. We didn't. We had the opposite. We didn't want Congress to go out. Didn't want accomplishments,
right.
And wanted to keep them in
right.
Town. So we threatened to veto adjournment resolutions. And it got to the point that they figured out that, you know, they could do a week at a time and maybe come in one day, let's say on the first,
do three recesses that would, you know, follow, and they wouldn't have to come back until the end. And we said, if you do that in that form, we'll veto them. They have to be done and sent to us.
Wow.
And they bought it.
Yeah.
They did it. And they stayed around, and then and we sort of worked
it out.
Could
you have vetoed it?
Yeah.
At that point,
Eric Potash.
Yeah, curious about in presidential management of the two chambers, how the office uses lobbies. When I was a committee staffer on the House side, the only way we often felt we could find out what was going on the Senate side was talking to lobbies. We felt we couldn't call our counterparts in the other chamber. We'd ask the interest groups, the hell's going on over there? And how does the president use lobbies as a resource for gathering information about it or trying to influence the two chambers in the process?
Highly overrated.
Yeah.
Highly
overrated.
Fred's example, the NAFTA and those bills, you know, those are sort of, they stand out because there's so few, where you can mobilize the lobbying forces. But for the day in and day out, our intelligence was so much superior to the any outsider. And, you know, most of the time it was keeping the groups at bay as opposed to enlisting their support. It was the 80% of the work was trying to keep them from undermining what you're trying to do as opposed to help you.
Sometimes, too, you'd end up going on wild goose chases. Because, you know, they'd be giving you intelligence that perhaps was not that accurate. And I remember that from the Thomas nomination, because we had all these groups involved in the Thomas nomination. Everybody had their view about where a particular member of the Senate was on this issue. And, you know, you got to have the vice president to call him, because I just saw him last night and he's off the reservation and, oh my God, you know. And you start buying bridges by the time the process is over. So it's a lot easier to just sort of take that information under advisement.
Right. The fundamental fact is they have an agenda that is virtually never exactly coincident with your own. And the information they're going to give you is going to be filtered through that lens of their interest. And you can listen to it, but if you listen to it without discounting it to the degree that it's slanted, you're making a huge mistake.
Steve or Chuck or Karen, do you have any questions? Go ahead.
This may produce just a quick descriptive answer, and that's some kind of helpful use for many of us as well. When you talk about dealing with the House and the Senate from legislative affairs, how did you structure your offices to do that? And what, if any, differences were there between the House side and the Senate side in White House Congressional Liaison?
Collected the boxes.
Different strategies, different things that they focused on. In some of our literature, there's a discussion of the House side focused more on committees and the Senate side didn't specialize to that extent. Are those things accurate?
Probably not.
No, I don't think so.
our design in the Bush administration was just like it was in the Reagan administration, which is sort of like just like it was in the Ford administration that Max had been involved in.
Mm-hmm. I think it's been the same for years.
Yeah, there may be some difference in terms of the level of participation of special or deputy assistants to the president in the policy process and apparatus, but the reaching out and touching is virtually the same thing. At least it was in over the 12 years that I've referred to.
I think it's equally divided, House and Senate, the staff. I don't recollect any difference in the way we tried to assign responsibilities. It was typically by a cluster of committees. There was no real difference in going in philosophy how you went at it. I think that the individuals who did it adapted to the differences in the institutions.
And you'd always be cognizant of, you know, of personal relationships, of course, which are important. But the split was House, Senate, and by substance and committee, and that seemed to work best. But of course, when you wanted to count votes, et cetera, Dan Tate knows this guy. Go send Dan to talk to this guy. Mm-hmm. You know.
I have noted, I believe, a stylistic difference, I believe, I'd be interested to test the proposition here, between some of the Republican White House affairs operations and certainly the Clinton one. In that my friends who worked in the Reagan Bush White House, the instruction, let's say, to House deputies, is that you always called a member by his first name. It was Jim, Bob, Pete, you know, whatever. Theory being, you're as close as they're going to get to the president that day. You're not a staffer. It's not Congressman Smith. It's not Congressman whatever. And at least when I came into Ledge Affairs, I had to tell people, you know, yeah, you're not staffers. It's Bill, Bob, Mary, whatever. And while, you know, I mean, it's, you know, minor, I mean, I think it does indicate a little bit of, you know, what's the relative relationship between the you and the member and the two branches. Was there such a, you told people to call him by their...
Well, I didn't call John Dingell John.
Well, there was just... If you did, it was John.
Well, you didn't know he was Willis.
We were just... Bob.
We were just the opposite, Joe.
Really?
I told him to call him Congressman and Senator. And I literally, this is not bragging, but I literally did know at one time every member of the House by their first name. But I would never, ever call them by their first. I would always say Congressman. I'd learned that very early when I was a House staffer. I had a friend that was in congressional relations, and he always referred to the members as Congressman. One day I said to him, why do you always call them Congressman? You know them so well. He said, they've earned that title. They were elected by 500,000 people. It's the most important job in the country. And he said, it's a sign of respect. And I never forgot that. And we really emphasized that you, the lowest member, the freshman member, was Congressman. He was never first named.
Or Mr. Chairman. Or...
I did it a little bit differently. I didn't direct my staff one way or the other in terms of how to refer to members. I, you know, always in a public environment, it was Senator or Mr. Chairman or Congressman. But I mean, I did develop relationships with members of Congress where I'm on a first name, was on a first name basis with them. And, you know, if you're up with eight members upstairs hanging out with the president, having a little cocktail to try to talk about an issue, I mean, it was, they felt comfortable, and we did it privately like that. But
was the Senate as easy to crack in that regard as the House was? Was there a greater reluctance to?
I saw no. I didn't have a problem with it.
So no lesser sense of approachability.
No, I mean, I didn't run around calling Bob Byrd Bob, you know. But it really depended upon the individual, and there were some guys that you could just get close enough to, sure, that you could have that kind of a relationship. But you never took advantage of it in a public sort of a setting, which showed that you thought you might be, your pants were too big or something, and you were calling somebody.
It seems like a small thing, titles, but it's very important. And I remember when President Ford took office, and so many of the members would call him Jerry, not Mr. President.
Yeah.
And over the years, President Ford has had an annual dinner at the Capitol Hill Club in June for all the former White House staff and cabinet. And Priscilla and I always sit with a Michigan delegation. Broomfields of this world, the Cedarbergs, the Chuck Chamberlains, the old guys. And President Ford always comes around to each table and makes a little chit-chat. And they all say, hi, Jerry. How you doing, Jerry? And Bob Griffin, who... Senator Griffin, he always resented that. He every time he would say to me, why do they call him Jerry? He said, God damn it, he's the president, you know. But he would say it, tell Cedarburg about it, he'd tell Broomfield about it. You think they listen to him? It's Jerry all the time. Of course, President Ford, I mean, it didn't make any difference to him, but Griffin thought it diminished, when he was in office, it diminished the familiarity of calling him Jerry, diminished his just the respect and the political clout with the other members. And but you're never going to change those guys. They're going to call him Jerry till the day he dies.
Dick, did you have one final question?
I'll ask it first when we resume.
That sounds splendid. We'll break the lunch. Thank you all.